All right, so we are in the book of Esther, and we are going to begin tonight in chapter 2, verse 5. However, I do want to, and I was really hoping that Ken and Linda would be here tonight, because we did kind of at their prompting talk about this idea of all of the communication that took place this last time. And, essentially we had King Xerxes give a statement to all 127 provinces throughout his kingdom that I'm divorcing Vashti, right? She's no longer part of it. And she was banished, or something happened to her. She was no longer to come before the king. For visual sake, and I know the back of the room and even the front of the room can't even see this, right? Get your binoculars out, but it would be fun after class, you come up here and you look at these little pointers, okay? So, first of all, the map on the right basically shows you this is India, Pakistan, this is current day maps, okay? Where we are. This little dot right here kind of shows the roundabout kingdom of Persia, which is what we're talking about in Esther. So, India, Pakistan, Afghanistan, Iran, Iraq, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Israel, Syria, Jordan, Egypt, Sudan, and all the way down in here to Ethiopia and Somalia. All of that area, plus, as you go up, you get into Turkey, and just a little bit into Macedonia, is how far King Xerxes' kingdom was. Okay, so the map on the left shows us these little red areas, the red areas. So all of this is basically a blown up version of this little bitty map. This is all of the modern day Persia area. Turkey continues up here with Macedonia coming up over here off the screen, or off the board. But I do have this little red line here indicates where Israel is as far as geographically where we are. And then we have this green line in the middle of Iraq is Babylon, one of three primary, Babylon, so we have an understanding of where King Nebuchadnezzar was, right? We kind of talked about it a little bit last time. The blue arrow is where Susa, the citadel, is. Okay, that's the citadel that we're talking about inside this book. It is one of three capital cities or ruling locations for the Persian kingdom. Now, they had capitals throughout all of the provinces that they managed, but these are the three that all of things happened. So the Winter Palace, which is where we are right now in Susa, that's in blue because it's winter. The one just to the north is I don't know how to say it. So it's just one that we haven't talked about, but it's up here, and it's gonna and I'll tell you why in just a minute. And then this one in the yellow is a place that we also didn't talk about, but was called Persepolis. Now Persepolis, as far as the Persian kingdom, Persepolis was the ceremonial capital for Persia. And it's interesting that we talk about all of this because at work, during lunch, I turn on the Roku channel because there's a TV and nobody talks to me and it's convenient for me. So I turn on the Roku TV and I go down to whatever documentary is playing, and there's a documentary on there called Unearthed. Season 9, Episode 1, which I began watching a week ago. So, Unearthed. Mm-hmm. Season 9, Episode 1, they talk about the lost city of Persia. And ironically, they talk about Persepolis as being built by King Darius the First. Class, do we remember who King Darius the First was?
He was the king during Daniel and the Lion's Den.
Correct.
Xerxes' father.
Very good. So King Ahasuerus, or King Xerxes, that was his father. So all this is going to come in a minute. And we talked about this vast kingdom. How do you get the word out, right? So one of the things that they pointed out while they were going through and talking about Darius and this other 35,000 square foot building with 100 columns, with a wooden roof, that they would go in and have a parade of military might in front of visiting kings and dignitaries, that was built by Xerxes to show off the power of Persia. Inside Persepolis, they noted, how do you communicate throughout this vast kingdom? And one of the things they did was they had way stations. They realized, as they looked outside of Persepolis and as they looked outside of Susa, they had this royal road. Well, King Darius had built this royal road, and Xerxes kept it up, Artaxerxes kept it up. In fact, it was kept up for so long. Remember, we are in the approximate 500 BC time frame, and Alexander the Great came through in the mid to late 300 BC time frame and burned Persepolis and conquered Persia. Okay, we all know those names, but he used the royal road to do this. Along the royal road are way stations, kind of like our version of the Pony Express. They put way stations every 50 miles, give or take. Those are the ones they've found. There may be others.
Way station, like W-A-Y, not W-E-I-G-H, like we have way stations today.
Correct. It's not a weight station. It's a way, ride the horse to that spot, change out the horse, keep on riding.
On your way.
On your way, okay. Right? Pony Express. In fact, Herodias spoke about how quickly the Persian kingdom, how the Persian rulers could communicate throughout their kingdom in 9 to 12 days, depending on how urgent the information was, because of these way stations. In fact, has anyone ever heard the phrase, neither snow, nor rain, nor heat, nor the gloom of night? You ever heard that?
Mm-hmm.
Where's that from?
Post office. Pony Express.
Pony Express post office, right? Kind of. We adopted it. It was actually Herodias giving a description of how quickly that the messaging service used by the Persian rulers communicated throughout his vast kingdom. And they say that from Persepolis in any direction, all the way to Macedonia, all the way down to Ethiopia, all the way down in here to Saudi Arabia, no matter what direction, no more than 12 days to that location or back from that location would they find out what was going on. And if there was an uprising that they needed to go take care of, they would dispatch various armies stationed throughout the kingdom on that royal road, which is how they were communicating, and they would dispatch them through the royal road and get them there. So I just kind of wanted to point that out because I didn't know that last week, but I learned it this week, all because I watched this. I wasn't even trying to find it, and it popped right up, and I was like, ooh, I can answer more questions today. The show is called Unearthed. They do a lot of other things with the Egyptians, and they talk about all the hidden stories of ancient worlds. But I thought that was very, very unique. Season 9, Episode 1.
I listened to part of it. It was actually
Prime or
Roku.
Roku, okay.
So probably
so
Pluto.
Darius, Xerxes, and then Artaxerxes?
Correct. Darius, Xerxes, then Artaxerxes.
So this, so what, if what we're saying then, so when we were talking last week, because we were like, oh my gosh, it's going to take months to a year, really, it was a matter of half of a month-ish, if not less.
So potentially, they communicated that Vashti was no longer the queen in 12 days or less.
Yeah, why did she have to?
Throughout the kingdom.
And was that the same for when, like, the king kind of gave out that decree as well?
Yes.
Okay.
So 12 days, hey, by the way, we're taking all the girls back here.
Mm-hmm. So this was the wives honor your husbands, Queen Vashti's out, and then, yeah, we're
bringing in all the girls. Yeah, so I mean...
He's trying to cover his tail.
Yeah.
Probably. Yeah.
And you look at that over time, and of course there was 4 years that we say between chapter 1 and chapter 2, there was that 3.5 year gap where he went and fought the war over in Greece and came back. Just kind of put that in perspective. I know that's all free stuff. That's not what we're talking about tonight. But I thought it was very interesting at how quickly the Persian rulers had figured out how to communicate and track exactly what was going on.
I love that we had that discussion last week and we had speculated things. And then you just happen to run across this TV show. So answer those questions for us.
Yeah. There's no happenstance.
There's no happenstance, right? We'll get to the question at the end. Where's God? Right? All right. All right. So all the free stuff's over. We are 6.5 years into the reign of King Xerxes when we hit chapter 2 and verse 5. So we will start with chapter 2, verse 5, verses 5 and 6. I'll begin, and it says this. Now there was in the citadel of Susa a Jew of the tribe of Benjamin, named Mordecai, son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, who had been carried into exile from Jerusalem by Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon. I apologize, it wasn't last week that we talked about Babylon, just was in my head because that's when I started studying it. That's that little green line I showed you where Babylon was. That's where Nebuchadnezzar and Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, right? That's where they were. So he was the king of Babylon. Among those taken captive with Jehoiakim, king of Judah, verses 6. Okay. So we have just learned that Mordecai is from the tribe of Benjamin. In all of our studies, do we know anyone else who was from the tribe of Benjamin?
Saul.
Saul, also known as?
Kish's son.
Paul. Right?
This Kish.
Oh, yeah.
Was that Saul?
What?
Was it Kish, the father of Saul? King Saul? He was a Benjamite.
Okay, yeah, possibly King Saul. Yeah, King Saul was a Benjamite, yes. And I was in the New Testament when you said that. I'm sorry. Yes, you are correct. King Saul of 1 Samuel was from the tribe of Benjamin. Mordecai was from the tribe of Benjamin. And jump to the New Testament, who was from the tribe of Benjamin? Who was a Pharisee and was killing Christians for a little while? The other Saul, Paul, right? So I find it interesting that Mordecai is part of this. He's a descendant of some of the first exiles that came out when Nebuchadnezzar went in and took the royal family and took them out and took them to Babylon. All of the royal family came with, and he is a descendant of that royal family. So we'll go this way, and we'll read verse 7. Please. Oh, and by the way, for those who don't know, this is the Esther Scepter. And when you have the Esther Scepter, you get to talk, or you can pass it and somebody else will read.
And he brought up Hadassah, that is Esther, and his uncle's daughter, for she had neither father nor mother. And the maid was fair and beautiful. And Mordecai, when her father and mother were dead, took for his own daughter.
Okay. So what is the relationship here that we have between Mordecai and Esther?
Uncle, dad.
Yeah. Yeah, uncle, dad. Good.
Uncle, dad.
Uncle, dad. All right, so let's verses 8 and 9, please.
And she's an orphan, right?
And she's an orphan.
Aren't they cousins? Because he said Esther is his uncle's daughter. My so uncle's daughter would be my cousin.
Yes, they're cousins. Yeah, they're cousins.
Okay.
She is his cousin.
But also her.
But he raised her as if he was her father because her mom and dad died.
Right.
So he's not dad, but he's stepdad. Right? He's acting as a father figure for Esther. And so her mom and dad have died. She's an orphan. He takes her in. He raises her, teaches her all the things. And he's, the way I would call this, I would call him just as much dad as anyone else. Right? So we have to kind of paint that picture as we go along this story. Right? Verses 8 and 9.
After the king had ordered to hold a beauty contest in each Persian province had been carried out, all the beautiful young finalists were brought to the palace in Susa and put under the care of Haggai. Esther was one of the finalists. She too was brought to the palace, placed under his care because he was the master eunuch in charge of the king's harem. Esther made a good impression on Haggai, and soon she won his favor. He lost no time in getting her ready for the final event by beginning her beauty treatments early and providing her with a special diet. He gave her the best room in the harem and assigned 7 young girls from the palace to help in her training.
Okay. Does this sound like anything else?
I was going to say, his translation makes this sound a lot more nicer than what it is. The beauty pageant. And
yeah.
I was going to say, I have a note that says, it is impossible to tell if Esther went voluntarily or against her will.
Doesn't that say?
Yeah, it doesn't say.
Yeah, so
agree, so she had to follow.
Yeah.
She didn't have a choice.
Didn't have a choice, right?
Right.
Yeah, beauty pageant thing's not really.
Yeah. So one of the things that we said, the nice thing about, I'm going to say this, the nice thing about the Common English version, it puts it in plain words and you know kind of what's going on, right? The real picture is she's taken from her family. They have decreed that all the virgins are the ones who are supposed to go. And we talked last week that this was about a desire of the king, right? So, do you find her finding favor quickly in the eyes of the eunuch similar to any other story in the Bible?
Mary, Joseph, Daniel.
Yeah, I was going to say Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Daniel chapter 1, where they found favor in the eyes of the eunuch that was taking care of them. And they were, King Nebuchadnezzar was going to actually kill them all. And he was like, wait. Just feed us this stuff, not the bread offered to idols. We'll just eat this salad and give us 60 days and or whatever the number was. And let's do an evaluation, right? And all of a sudden, they were able to outperform everyone. They found favor in the eyes of that. It's just very interesting how these play together, that God's person or God's people have been put in these difficult situations and yet they find favor in the eyes of their captor, their master, or the person watching over them.
Just like they also have the Persia, the media laws, like that can't be revoked.
Yeah.
The same thing.
Yeah.
That it talks about today.
Yeah.
I'm crazy interested in the 7 maidservants.
Yeah, so...
that sounds exciting. 7 people to... I mean,
7 people to dote after you,
I was
going to
say, yeah, I mean, this serves a purpose. I'm making light of it. But I mean, right. You know, I think it goes along with the favor that you were talking about. She had such favor that she had 7 attendants taking care of her. So.
Yeah.
Well, it was probably one for makeup, one for hair, one for
clothes, and
exactly.
Yeah.
Right. I think it's interesting that all this favor is just only with Haggai. She hasn't even seen the king yet.
Yeah.
So it makes me wonder if she would have had that much favor with the king if she hadn't first had the favor with Haggai.
So we're going to get to that here in just a few minutes. I think that, but I think putting a pin in that is a good conversation, right? The other thing I want to ask, what kind of environment do you think this creates amongst all of these young women who have been taken to the palace? In some versions, whether it's the New King James or the NIV, we actually find out that she's put in a completely different place. I mean, still in the House of Women, but she's elevated into her own room with seven people to take care of her very quickly. What kind of environment, what kind of behavior, or what kind of...
Women get jealous really quickly.
Thank you.
Yeah, I was going to say, what happens when you get a bunch of women together? And...
Yeah.
I wasn't going to say that, but that's a good conversation. Right? I mean, do you think there was an awful lot of contention? I mean, certainly could be a lot of contention here, right?
I mean, it's kind of like we talked about a little bit of the, like, just the cultural impact of this last week. But, I mean, it's also this, you know, you're putting this, this is a beautiful female. You seven other women have to attend to her because she's prettier than you. You know, and it is jealousy, but again, it's just more so the fact of this kind of like, like if you're beautiful, you deserve to be owned. But also, if you're beautiful, or if you're ugly, you need to tend to the beautiful. And the beautiful don't even matter. So what do you matter if you're just there to make the prettier? You know.
Right.
Well, I don't think the recruiters would have brought anybody in who wasn't work beautiful. They're all be beautiful. I would imagine they're all thinking, if I'm going to be taken from my family and I have to live here forever, I at least want to be, you know, seeing the king and being taken care of, right? Mm-hmm. So I think.
Yeah.
I think initially they probably all had some camaraderie because they're all been taken, so they're all kind of in the same boat initially. But then, as things progress, it's probably an all-out.
Well, when she doesn't come back,
I think it'd be honoring to the family. Like, to me, you're back in this time, a lot of honor to your family. So if you were taken, you know, this is women that have many rights. So they, their only rights was to show honor for their family by who and which they married. So they're all trying probably more for, I would say, that of bringing honor to their family. And if they didn't make it, you know, maybe they put shame to their father's house, you know, because they didn't make to a certain, that's where my brain was.
Yeah.
I like how someone mentioned it, I don't know who, but kind of like the camaraderie? Yeah, camaraderie amongst the women, because like I'll say this kind of from my own personal experience. I've lived with, before for like 2 months, 46 females.
That's
awful. And, I will say at the end of the day, there is camaraderie in that sense, yes, where like you all stick together and stuff, but at the end of the day, you still do the fight. You all love each other dearly, but you all fight, and you gotta get away from that sometimes. But I'm sure in this situation, like, knowing that you have to honor and respect this one individual, and your whole life is dedicated to caring for them, I'm sure there's a lot of mixed feelings among those women, and as well as that, probably with Esther too, because she's probably thinking, or I can't say this, but if I was in the same position, I'd probably be thinking, first off, I'm not that important. I don't know why you people are always here attending to me. Also, I can do things myself, you know, and also too, being nervous about having such a big role as well. But yeah.
Yeah, especially when she's already been given a lot of favor by Haggai.
That's a big
Haggai, right? I mean,
yeah.
Giving her special food that no one else got, quickly bringing her into the I think it said, quickly began her beauty treatments, you know, the oils and the spices. And
keep in mind too, Queen Vashti just got kicked out. So I'm sure she's probably feeling, I would be feeling that I would be walking on eggshells just a little bit.
Yeah, 3.5 years ago. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And he just did it like that.
Yeah.
It's still fresh in everyone's mind.
They only have one chance.
Right.
It's not like they've got, you know, time.
Yeah.
To impress the king. They don't want to pay him.
And we have not a clue if Queen Vashti was just told to leave or if she was hung or what. We don't have a clue. We don't have a clue in the context for that.
I heard one commentator state, it's difficult to go through the Book of Esther and not read into it stuff that isn't there, and not read into stuff that we want to imply that's there, right? He said it's very difficult because we have to look at this from a perspective of this story is told to children time and time and time again. So there are some levels of details that are left out of this. Because as we said from the very beginning, this is a story, this is the historical story of the Feast of Purim that is still celebrated today in Israel, right? By the Israelites, by the Jews, those who choose. This is still a story that it's kind of like their Halloween, right?
But I don't know if I agree with that or not, because they were supposed to tell their kids, give them the law in future generations, and the law is brutal.
Oh, I agree.
You can't leave out all the death and all the killing and all that stuff in the law. So I don't know why you would take it out of the story.
Right, and I say that as prefaced as we get ready to dive into some of the more difficult parts of this conversation, because there are many commentators that sit on both sides and excoriate Esther for going through this process and not standing up. They excoriate her for not proclaiming that she's a Jew, not proclaiming who her heritage is. In fact, that our very next verse is, well, go ahead and read verse 10.
Esther had not revealed her people or family, for Mordecai had charged her not to reveal it.
Yeah, and that word charged in some of your versions is the word what?
Ordered.
Instructed.
Ordered, instructed.
Forbidden.
Forbidden. Right? Don't tell anyone who you are. So let me ask you this question, and we're going to see this again in just a minute, but because this same exact statement is going to be told again. Why would she not say who she is? Why would Mordecai say, don't reveal your nationality? You know, and let me put it in this perspective. Okay, let me paint a picture that some commentators have put out there. That, well, you are a Jew and you should stand up and tell everyone that you are a Jew and you are not going to do XYZ because you're a Christian or you're a Jew. Okay? I'm using that word interchangeably, not. The commentator is very frustrated that Mordecai says, don't tell anybody who you are. But let me ask you, why would Mordecai do that?
So I'm going to answer that with a question. What was his role?
Mordecai?
Yeah.
So we find, at the end of this chapter, we find out he's sitting at the city gate. Does anyone remember what the city gate is for?
Court.
Court. Right.
He's probably like a councilman or nobleman or elder.
Right.
So the king probably knows who he is.
I would, yes. He's going to know by the end of chapter 2 who he is. But he is constantly involved in something.
So he knows the environment of what's happening.
Protection.
So it's a protection piece, yeah.
But Then he didn't know that she was his cousin or related to him or his daughter or whatever.
Yeah, nobody knew that.
Do you think at the time, like when Mordecai told this to Esther, do you think at the time Mordecai knew of Haman?
That's a great question.
Because I feel like that would influence a lot.
I think it would. And I think Haman was, I think he came along the scene. I think they had their interaction. But I think when we get to Haman in chapter 3, we're actually year 12 of this story. Right? When Haman begins to be introduced, now we're in year 12 of the story. So we had King Xerxes throws a party at his third year of reign. And then we have this 3.5 years, he goes off to war. Now we're at 6.5. We're just about to enter into year number 7 of his reign. Right? So 4 years have passed now. And then when we get to chapter 3, we roll to 12 years. 5 years later of Queen Esther being queen, now all of a sudden Haman gets his panties in a wad.
Well, there's also the problem with her being a Jew and being the queen, because death is always a possibility.
Right.
And of course that's what ended up being.
And they were slaves. They right. were captured. They were in captivity under the Persian rule.
But the whole story was about killing Jews.
Right.
So the place probably would have been in an uproar, the whole kingdom, if he married a Jew. If he knew it.
My question was, what was the current culture? Were Jews allowed to be in the palace or go before the king, or were they,
Were Jews allowed to marry people that weren't Jewish?
Well, the king can marry whoever he wants.
Right.
And clearly, that's what we have going on. And Mordecai is just saying, hey, you don't need to tell anybody who you are.
Would this be the second exile?
I can't answer that. I'll look for that answer.
And I would say,
I think it's a continuation. It's a continuation of the exile from Babylon. So when Nebuchadnezzar took the royal family to Babylon, Persia conquered Babylon, they have all these people, and then they start moving people into all of these places of, hey, I need some servants down here, and you go over there, and you go over there, and I need something over there, right? That's kind of, these are still the descendants of that, of Nebuchadnezzar's initial grab.
Well, the Assyrians had already taken Israel. This is Judah we're talking about.
Right.
Is that what you're talking about?
Is that what you mean?
Yeah, I was just thinking about the back and forth.
Okay, so this is King Nebuchadnezzar taking the rest of it. Yeah. Okay, so we are in verse 11. So why are we here? What do we see here in verse 11?
Do you want me to read it?
Yes, please.
Okay, I wasn't for sure if we read it. It was my turn to read or not. Every day Mordecai paced in front of the court of the women's quarters to learn of Esther's welfare and what was happening to her.
Okay, so what do we see Mordecai doing?
Checking on her, making sure that his daughter is okay.
Yeah, he's a concerned dad. You'd be walking the fence line, waiting to hear something, and right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So now let's read verses 12 through 14.
I don't do it. All right, 12 through 14. Now on the turn of each young lady came to go in the king Ashurus, or Xerxes, after the end of her 12 months under regulations for the women. For the days of their beautification were completed as follows: 6 months with oil of myrrh and 6 months with spices and the cosmetics for women. The young lady would go into the king in this way, anything she desired was given to her to take with her from harem, is that how you say it?
From the harem, yep.
From the harem to the king's palace. In the evening, she would go in, and in the morning, she would return to the second harem, to the second, or I'm sorry, the custody of Shashagaz,
mm-hmm.
the king's eunuch, who was in charge of the concubines. She would not again go to the king useless, or unless, I'm sorry, I'm really chopping that one up, unless the king delighted in her and she was summoned by name. So, right, read that again.
Yeah, no, that's okay. So what's the process that we're getting ready to go through? What has taken place for a whole year now? We're prepping, right? Making the oil smell good, making the skin smell good, putting on a little bit of spice, a little amber, a little whatever.
Her beauty routine.
Getting through her beauty routine, getting her habits all done, getting her nails, making sure she brushes her teeth, all the things, right?
And then Shashagaz.
Yep.
He was in charge of the concubines.
Yeah.
So Haggai brought them to him.
Haggai delivered each young lady to the king. And then when the king was done that evening or that morning, they went a completely different route and never returned to the house of women. They went to a different part of the house.
Unless they were summoned by name, right?
Correct.
Well, after spending the evening with the king, they were no longer allowed to go to the first house.
Because they were no longer
virgins.
Correct.
Why do they say she was given whatever she desired to take with her from the women's quarters?
So
she's not coming back.
Because she's not coming back.
Ah, true. Okay, that went through me. Okay, yeah.
Taking all your belongings? Or are you taking the? What are you taking? Because I'm not coming back here. What am I not leaving behind? Am I taking my teddy bear? Am I taking my blankie? Am I taking my shoes? You know, what are you packing?
That makes sense. Okay.
Right. Mm-hmm. And I
was thinking, like, also whatever you're taking to impress the king, you can that's request what I whatever was, you want. Yeah. You know, certain dress, whatever, because you're trying your best to impress the king to be
with one. When you're going to the king, you should be dressed and ready for the king at that point. Mm-hmm. So, I'm assuming that this is going to be like for the next day. Her clothes.
Yeah, but she's not. Yeah, she's not coming back, right?
Right.
So I find the next part very interesting because it doesn't tell us, and that's interesting to me. So let's read verses 15 through 16, please.
Okay. Esther was the daughter of
Abihail.
Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had adopted her as her own daughter. When her return came to the king, she did not ask for anything except what Haggai, the king's eunuch, keeper of the woman, suggested. Esther gained favor in the eyes of everyone who saw her. She was taken to King Xerxes in the palace in the 10th month, the month Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign.
Okay. What did she take? Yeah, exactly what Haggai said to take. She didn't take anything extra. She didn't take anything more or anything less. Just so, what happened here?
She followed directions.
Yeah, she followed the directions and she listened. Can you imagine how? I don't want to get bad, and I want to be very, very protective of the fact that we don't want to read more into this than what we should. But how difficult would that be?
To only bring the minimum?
Yeah, to only bring what Haggai said to bring. Now, I mean,
obedience.
Yeah.
It's also kind of, I would think almost, it's kind of brilliant in the fact that, you know, he also has a somewhat personal relationship with the king. And so he knows that, like, this isn't going to, like, not be too graphic, this isn't going to do it for him. This is what he likes. This is that. You know, so it's easier for all parties if, you know.
Not only is she beautiful, not only does she listen, but she is set up for success in front of the king. I just think that's a very interesting part of the story. And again, when we get to our ending question, which is, where is God, right? Where was God in all of this, and what was God working on, and how was he working through all of this? So let's read verses 17 through 18, please.
The king loved Esther more than all the other women. She won more favor and approval from him than did any of the other virgins. He placed a royal crown on her head and made her queen in place of Vashti. Mm-hmm. The king held a great banquet for all of his officials and staff. It was Esther's banquet. He paid his provinces for tax payments and gave gifts worthy of the king's bounty.
Okay. So what has happened?
She won,
right? She's queen. She was memorable. What is King Xerxes' response?
I got a side question.
Go ahead.
All the other women that were set aside, are those still his concubines?
There are still his
versions. Everybody else go home. This is your role now. She's the best, but
they're not his wife.
Not his wife, but like they're still like his concubines. They're not leaving the palace.
They're not leaving.
But I'm not sure all the other ladies were sent home.
No. They weren't. In fact, once we get done with this little bitty conversation, our very next verse says something shocking.
Just need to be quiet.
No, you're fine. I guess my question is, what is Xerxes' response?
Excitement.
Banquet.
Just like he did at the beginning.
Correct. Mm-hmm. He's overselling it again.
Like his mood has been lifted.
He also gives the gifts to the prophets, so he's blessing all the people for...
Yeah, he's doing something with taxes and either relieving them or giving them all a break for a minute or something, right?
To win favor of the people, too.
Right. And so now he's, I've got a wife again, right? I've got a queen. This is her. And so now we push out that proclamation, right? So now, you know, 12 days, everybody knows. Now it's Queen Esther. She's my queen. So what happens in verse 19?
When the virgins were assembled a second time, Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate. But Esther had kept secret her family, background, and nationality, just as Mordecai had told her to do. For she continued to follow Mordecai's instructions as she had done when he was bringing her up.
Very good. So, in verse 19, what do we find out?
He was sitting at the king's gate.
He was sitting at the king's gate. What did we find out before that?
When the virgins were gathered the second time.
For a second time. That means there was another wave of virgins coming in. So to your point, did it stop? Hey, I found my queen. Did it stop? No.
Really just a big womanizer. It's like you already have a queen. It's right. Like, you know, it's gonna calm down. Jeez.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
So
I was just gonna say that in the 10th month is when Queen Esther went into the king. So how many days, you know, 9 months worth of him trying to find a queen. But I mean, 10 months worth. So he had all those concubines, essentially, and now we're still.
So what was the job of a concubine? Does anyone know? Please the king, bear them children. So Queen Esther also bore children. She is believed, again, in this thing, documentary I read, not in that documentary, in a different one. She bore him four sons. Queen Esther bore him four sons. And then they were military leaders in his kingdom. But the concubines also, they say that to King Xerxes alone, he had over 100 children from all of these other ladies that were his concubine wives.
So I have a question. Are we to assume that when it talks about the second group of virgins, that that was after he had anointed his queen?
Absolutely.
Just because it's in that order, we can't know that? Or
because...
Could it just be they're moving, seeing something different and lining up the next storyline?
No. Because as we continue through this conversation on just inside this verse, we find that we are going to see Esther is the queen.
Okay.
So this behavior is still going on while she's queen. So this is the second time that we have read in verse 20, she hasn't told anybody who she is. Is everybody okay with that? You see, the reason I ask the question is because there are all sorts of morality. I'm going to call them morality police about this particular piece. She didn't tell anybody who she was. She hasn't told them that she's a Jew. She behaved in such a manner that we wouldn't want our daughters to participate in, willingly or otherwise, and the commentators seem to say that she was, some commentators were willing, she was willing to go through this process, and she was acceptable of the process, and I'm looking at everyone's face, and everyone's sitting here going, shut up, I don't want to talk about it, because I don't believe, you know, because what we're doing is we're keeping true to the word. I just want to make sure that as we go through these things in a Bible study, that we're not letting our mind run amok and we stick to the storyline, right? Does that make sense? We don't want to impugn or take away from the story. So,
that's our instruction from the past.
Do I?
That's our instruction
from the past. Right. All right, so verses 21 to 23.
In those days, while Mordecai sat in the king's gate, two of the king's chamberlains, Bigthan and Teresh, of those which kept the door, were wroth and sought to lay a hand on the king Ahasuerus. And the thing was known to Mordecai, who told it to Esther the queen, and Esther certified the king thereof in Mordecai's name. When the inquisition was made of the matter, it was found out. Therefore, they are both hanged on a tree, and it is written in the book of the Chronicles before the king.
Okay. What's happened? We see one, Queen Esther is queen.
I have a question, just to ask for clarification.
Sure.
So when it mentions, like, the two eunuchs.
Yes.
Are those, like, two, like, of the male servants? Okay.
Eunuchs are male servants.
Got
yep.
you. So, I wonder, why were they so angry then? Sorry.
Okay, good question. Your statement?
Well, last Sunday I looked up what a eunuch was.
Yeah.
Figure it out.
Yeah, what'd you learn?
Maybe they had just become eunuchs.
they were,
yeah,
they
yeah,
were,
they're castrated. Yeah,
they weren't born that way.
No.
Right.
For whoever they served, or however it...
Yeah, so if you serve the king, if you're a male and you serve the king is protecting his line, right? You're in charge, so...
You're
open.
Charge of those ladies in the.
You're in charge of the House of Women.
So you're, yeah.
Okay. And guess what? You're making good friends, and there's some pretty hot ones in there, and like Esther, they hit it off just right now. Everything's going good. What can happen? Right? We all know what can happen. All of a sudden, everybody's starting to get together, and now all of a sudden, the king doesn't get what he's looking for. So, if you're serving the king and you're a eunuch, hey, guess what? You're not participating in that behavior because you don't have anything to do that. And it's a protection of the king's line.
Mine actually just says the king's officials from those who guard the door.
That's the two men that were...
The eunuch, the eunuchs.
Yeah.
I just find it interesting that it says just, it doesn't necessarily say eunuchs, but it says king's officials.
Yeah. So
maybe they had some, maybe they, I don't know, your says eunuch. Mm-hmm. It's just interesting to mind that it's a eunuch.
Mine says officers too.
Yeah.
Yeah, mine says that you can be a eunuch and be an officer, right? You're serving the king. Any male that was around the king that was going to be serving in his house, there were parts of that man that didn't exist anymore.
But he was out. They were outside because they were guarding the door.
Correct. Yeah. How do you get in the door?
They could rotate them.
Yeah, they could rotate, but you still got to open the door. You're still going to see all the things. You're still going to be a little bit tempted.
Sure.
So what is Bigtha and Teresh upset about? We don't know. I have a pretty good idea. I'm just going to leave it out there, right? I think.
Yep.
I'm a little frustrated, right? And all of a sudden, you know, two reasons, right? And so now, they're found out that they were plotting to assassinate the king. And what does the king do? He takes care of him. He hung him. Yeah. And in fact, it in some of the commentaries, they describe that what the Persians really did was, after they died, they hung them up. Mm-hmm. To kill them, they impale them. And then, once they're dead, they hang them for all to see. Impaled. Yeah.
Sometimes they burn them at the stake, too, after they impale them.
Yeah. Here they...
Mine doesn't say that. It just says hung on the gallows.
Hung on to the gallows.
Yeah.
Yeah, so the NIV keeps it kind of nice. The New King James, King James says that they're impaled. And they are, and what?
Hanged on a tree.
And hanged on a tree.
It doesn't say impaled.
Sharpened pole.
Mine doesn't say impaled. King James doesn't say impaled, just
it says hung on the gallows.
What is yours?
I like this right now.
Mine's NIV.
Yeah.
Mine says hanged on
impaled.
Yeah, mine says hanged on the gallows, but the note for that verse says that Persian execution consisted of being impaled, and is likely they were inventors of crucifixion.
There you go. So we also found out here that Mordecai is not allowed to directly speak to Queen Esther, is he?
Mm-hmm.
He had to go through. Go ahead.
And it says that it was written in the Chronicles, so the Book of Chronicles, in the king's presence. So then it also made known and accounted, written in, like, look, this is what happens. This happened, and this is what will happen as a warning to others.
Yeah, and who was responsible for reporting it? Okay, so one of the things that we're going to see maybe next week or at least the week after that is that, do we have a record right now of any reward for Mordecai for bringing this to the Esther queen, the queen and the king's attention?
No, I just wrote it in a book.
Yeah, he just wrote it down in a book and everybody went on, right? So this event in a couple of chapters is going to come back and I would say haunt the king because he's going to realize, hey, I did we do anything for that guy?
I was going to say, isn't this one of those where the king's doing some light reading at nighttime and
he can't sleep?
Because he can't sleep. I love how that is addressed. It is so funny. Every time I read it, I get such a good laugh out of it. I'm sorry, but it's just me.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking of.
Hey, bring the scribe in here and tell me what happened over the last month.
Yeah.
The last couple of years.
And then
right,
he decides,
5 years later.
Hey, did we send him a fruit basket? No.
So
God was in charge of Mordecai, and he was written in the book.
Yeah. So what all the things, what are part of our premise a couple of weeks ago was we can never see what God is doing in our life. It may be 30 years you don't know what's going on in your life. As a way, and as it relates to what God has planned for you, right? You're just going through life and you don't understand. Because we have the opportunity to see 2020 throughout this chapter, what are all the things that God was doing that we know? Because I'm assuming many of us have read ahead and read some of the chapter, read the story. What are the things that God is doing throughout this chapter for Mordecai, Esther, and even the king? What has God been doing with all the actors that we have here?
Took the little orphan and the stepfather or the dad or the uncle or the cousin, whatever you want to consider it. So he took Esther in. So then, therefore, she had someone to take care of her and lead her through her life.
God made that provision. That's exactly what I was thinking.
And then, in turn, it blessed him later, and it brought wealth and honor to the king.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. But what happened was the men both were hung on the was it Galatians?
Gallows.
Yeah. Yeah. That's kind of sad, too. But
yeah.
That's what happened.
He wants building a relationship between the king and Esther. A relationship of trust.
So she came from an orphan to a queen, and he went from basically a, I don't know.
I mean, he spent 12 years essentially as an elder with a bunch of backstabbing. Like, I can't imagine that was, it's a hard thing to do for 12 years and stay honorable. Mm-hmm. Honorable enough that you're still going to, hey, I know you're doing all these horrible things to these young women, but these two guys are going to kill you, you know?
Yeah, so let's talk about that for just a hot second. You have dad, uncle, whatever you want to call him. You've got the dad figure. And you have Esther, who violated by the king. She's queen now, so okay. But how do you deal with that?
I think where God is that he still has, like, even though all the women were made to come there, they didn't really have choice, but he still was able to check on her by where he was able to go to the palace and talk to her and check on her. I think that's a blessing as a parent. That's where I would see God. And then it even worked out in his favor even further in the fact that he was able to show, honor to the king by spotlighting these people that were out to kill him, which for me, I think that he's actually protecting Esther because he's the man that's over his daughter now. And so he's protecting that man so that his daughter would be protected. Because if he was king, what would happen to her?
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't it interesting that despite all of the good and bad choice opportunities that are here in this chapter, God is not shocked. God is still working in and through all of the decision-making process.
Mm-hmm.
God was also working with Mordecai in the fact that, and you alluded to it with all these people who were mad or upset or were questioning why they weren't revealing that she was a Jew. Having heard everything we've talked about Esther, Mordecai, I'm sure, was, God was working through Mordecai, as we well know, as we've talked about. But I think from that perspective too, he knew that it wasn't time to say, I'm a Jew or I'm not a Jew. I don't know that he was withholding it because he wanted to lie about it or anything. I think God was like, yeah, not time, not time.
It never not really time. Came up as a need it, to right. say, it, right?
Yeah, I just don't think that it wasn't time to say it, because God had a purpose in it happening that way. So I feel like from that perspective too, God was working through Mordecai in that way as well.
I think as we look at the end of the story, when Esther does reveal that she's a Jew, I'm not certain that King Xerxes would have reacted in such a violent and angry, extreme way if he had known that prior to, right? I think it's interesting because next week, read chapter 3. Next week, we are going to do chapter 3, and we are introduced to Haman. And we get to learn his history, where he's from. He's introduced as Haman the Agagite. And you need to go back to 1 Samuel 15 and find out who Agag was. Okay? So that'll be fun. Any other thoughts before we...
Since we're interested in how he continued to be that protector for Esther.
Yeah.
Whether it's taken when she was young or as she continued to be queen.
And watched over her. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's awesome.
It's pretty steadfast. Just like God, right?
Yeah. It's cool. Heavenly Father, Lord, we love you. Thank you for the opportunity to again come around your word this evening and read about Esther and this story and just how you are in every single step of her life, Mordecai's life, and the men that were around them. Lord, help us to remember that in our own life. That as we go through difficulties each day, as we struggle with decisions or just process or just whatever it is, Lord, may we remember you already know and you are already in charge.
Amen.
I love you. I thank you for your word. I thank you for how it challenged me this week and how it challenges us this week. Pray, Lord, as we continue your study, that we would have our hearts turned to you. In Jesus' name. Amen.
Thank you, Tim.